Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bhumika, your host for today. And today we will be speaking with Professor Ajanta Subramanian on her new hot off the press, much awaited book called The Caste of Merit, Engineering Education in India, published by the Harvard University Press this December 2019. This is Professor Subramanian's second book, and her first book was called Shoreline, Space and Rights in South India, which was published by the Stanford University Press in 2009. I'm so excited and so happy to have you on this podcast, Ajanta. Welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Perfect. As we always do, Ajanta, I would like to begin our conversation today by asking you to tell us a bit about yourself, your arrival to anthropology, your choice of anthropology as both a pursuit and as a career now. So tell us a little bit more about how this happened, how all of this happened.
Yeah, sure. It was a little bit of a circuitous route that I took into anthropology. So when I was an undergraduate, I was at Bryn Mawr College, and I only took one anthropology course. And it was actually one that I didn't like. It didn't lead me to additional anthropology courses. I ended up majoring in religion with a focus on Christian theology, mainly because of a professor who taught me to read texts closely in a way that I found really enabling and inspiring. And within the study of Christian theology, I was especially drawn to the liberationist tradition because of how it foregrounds the experiences of the oppressed. As an interpretive vantage point, right, on that faith tradition. And my senior thesis compared the implications of structural oppression for an understanding of sin and redemption in the writings of two liberation theologians. One was James Cone, a Black American theologian, and Kay Wilson, who's a Dalit theologian. And I mean, I was really struck by their work, and the comparative project was really exciting to me. But by the end of college, I was pretty frustrated with a purely textual approach to religion, and I sort of began to look around for other options. After my BA, I went back to Chennai, where my parents live, and I did some journalism and activism, mainly around slum dwellers' rights in the city. And this was the early 90s when the Hindu right was on the rise. And I began reading more anthropological and historical work and slowly became convinced that anthropology would, in fact, be the best discipline for thinking about the politics of religion in India. And I initially went to graduate school in anthropology at Duke, to work on the rise of Hindu nationalism in Kanyakumari, which is the southernmost district in Tamil Nadu, the one that borders the state of Kerala. But I ended up focusing on, instead of focusing on Hindu nationalism itself, I ended up focusing on the principal target of the Hindu right in the district, which was this fishing community of low-caste Catholics. And so this focus kind of led me back to Indian Christianity and to the liberationist tradition within the Indian Catholic Church, but now through a historical anthropology of this fishing caste. So my first book, Shorelines, was a kind of significantly revised version of my dissertation that looked at this fishing community's long history of claims making and tried to understand this history of claims making as the basis for a post-colonial politics of rights. All of this might seem like a far cry from the focus of my second book, which is on the relationship between caste and merit within Indian engineering education. But I actually see both books as dealing with a lot of the same questions and approaches. So both address the history of caste, which has been sort of my principal preoccupation as a scholar. And both look at how colonial legacies of caste formation continue to shape the dynamics of post-colonial democracy. And in getting at the history of caste, in both of the books, I've looked at how caste has been incorporated into both colonial and post-colonial projects of capitalist transformation and of governance. And so thinking about caste within these kinds of projects meant moving beyond its treatment as a category that's emblematic of Indian cultural difference, to thinking a bit of it more as an instrument of classification and management that was imagined and sort of deployed in relation to other categories like race, class, tribe. And then I guess the last thing I'll say about the two books is that in both and this is not always explicit in the books, but in both of them, I sort of draw inspiration from Antonio Gramsci's work, especially Gramsci and Understanding of Hegemony, to think about caste. Although the first book does so in order to get at caste subalternity, and the second book does so to get at caste privilege. So I guess what I mean by a Gramscian approach is that I'm really interested in process and in getting at a more robust account of political process. And I find Gramsci's insistence on contingency really crucial for moving from thinking of power and politics mainly in terms of stable structural logics that kind of seamlessly reproduce themselves, to thinking of them in terms of unstable hegemonies that actually require work to maintain. And part of my ambition in this book in particular is to insist on the instability of meritocracy and to highlight this kind of wider field of contestation that makes this equation between caste, merit, and capital less of a guarantee, right? It's less of a given. And I think it's really important for me to emphasize this instability because, I mean, for one, it helps me get at a more properly historical account of how caste changes over time. Just to repeat myself, it lets us see the work that goes into the consolidation of caste power, right? Against certain kinds of pressures. And then the last thing is, so Gramsci has this very kind of useful approach to consciousness as a sort of set of historical sediments, right? Where these older meanings persist and combine with newer ones. And this combination sometimes shores up existing structures of inequality and at other times helps to unsettle them. And this way of thinking about a kind of a sedimented histories was very useful for me for getting at meritocracy, because merit is this term that works ideologically to mark a discontinuity, right, with older forms of social organization, where patronage and ascription mattered more than individual ability and achievement. And, you know, in this sense, I think meritocracy, as it's commonly understood, is sort of part of this liberal common sense, which assumes that the institution of formal equality has leveled the playing field and rendered all of these past inheritances irrelevant, right, opportunity and achievement. And in the book, I'm trying to show how this ideology of meritocracy actually obscures the role of caste inheritances in the present. But, you know, just so that's the sort of continuity part. But I'm also really interested in the power of merit as a claim that underwrites new things, like new forms of capital accumulation, new scales of caste identification. And so I'm trying to get at both of these aspects of the kind of history and present of caste.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Ajanta, for saying that. I mean, that, you know, that gives me pause to say that your own story about affection and disaffection with anthropology is, I suppose, an intimate relationship with a lot of anthropologists do have with anthropology per se. And so that's a wonderful sort of recounting of your own relationship with anthropology as it continues to unfold. And, you know, your insistence and the way in which you draw inspiration from Gramsci, in a way, when one reads your text, the idea of maneuvering and ways in which different positions of power maneuver is right there. So one doesn't even have to read between the lines to find that out. So that's, I can totally understand and appreciate the ways in which you bring those questions into an anthropological account of what caste and castelessness and claims to castelessness can mean in terms of claims to merit. So thank you for saying that. You know, there's so much to unpack in the book. There is, it's so rich in so many ways. And it's such a rigorous and systematic account of the embeddedness of caste privilege in the discourse on merit in engineering education in India. And you say this several times in the book as well. It won't be off the mark to say that the argument can be extended to other kinds of education and employment opportunities like law and bureaucracy, right? And you give us this perspective through a discourse on technical skills in education, particularly through the story of IIT Madras and its location within the field of Tamil regional politics as well. So in that sense, you know, the first question that I really wanted to ask you to address, invite you to address is, you know, is there something about the value of technical education itself? I don't want to exceptionalize it from other forms of education, other sort of forms of knowledge creation and appropriation, but is there something about technical education in the way that you talk about engineering education that can make it such a dual proposition for both the project of emancipation and conservatism, right? I mean, you said very beautifully in one of your chapters that technical education, I'm quoting, technical education has been more of a vehicle for advancing status claims than for transforming the caste basis of value. And that struck me in a way that, you know, I wanted to sort of know from you your own way in sort of choosing engineering education as a subject to talk about merit. I mean, of course, reads what you've been writing about it and speaking about it and the book itself, it makes so much sense. But for our listeners, I wanted you to, you know, offer a few comments about, can you unpack this, the kind of complexities the promise of technical education holds out and lies as far as the making and unmaking of caste privilege is concerned?
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, as you say, it's, one could extend this analysis to other educational sites, right? And of course, one could extend it well beyond India as well, right? To other institutions of higher education, whether in the US or elsewhere. For me, what's so interesting about technical education is that, like the term meritocracy itself, it was advanced as a kind of democratizing promise. Right? Technical education, unlike law, or even the humanities and social sciences, which were always seen more as a preserve of a social elite, technical education was seen as a social leveler, right? I mean, it was supposed to be the knowledge of the everyman, in part because of the way it allowed for embodied forms of labor, right? To enter new kinds of modernizing projects, right? So if you look at the colonial period in India, technical education is both heralded as something that will uplift, right, the commoner, right? At the same time that it is supposed to be part of this colonial state project of modernization. So it had this sort of promise of being a social leveler and of being a vehicle for enhancing the status of the colonial state. But it was always haunted by the hierarchies of colonial society, right? I mean, whether these were racial hierarchies. So if you look at the engineering services all through the late 19th century, there was a privileging of the English engineer over and above the Indian one, right? There were all of these sort of assumptions about who could best embody this new knowledge, right? And the white engineer was always seen as better able to embody this new knowledge. And similarly, once the field opened up to Indians and technical training was extended to so-called natives, you see other hierarchies kind of entering the fray, right? And caste becomes this really important instrument of stratification. So even though lower castes were recognized by colonial officials as having more skills, right? As having a kind of training in crafts, in forms of embodied labor, they were very quickly marginalized in favor of an upper caste elite, because there was this other side to technical education, right? It was supposed to be a high status pursuit that would shore up the kind of hierarchies of the colony and shore up the status of the state. And for those purposes, high castes were seen as much better suited, right? So there was always this sort of, and you know, this kind of contradiction, if you will, at the heart of technical education, that it was supposed to both be a leveler, both bring a kind of subaltern class into modern forms of knowledge and into modern industries, but it was also supposed to do this other work, right, of shoring up hierarchy, shoring up status.
That goes at the heart of what I was wanting to ask you. And, you know, that brings me, what you were saying right now, that brings me to the second question. So this process of shoring up hierarchies, this process of shoring up privileges, shoring up inheritances to kind of make it converted into then a sort of a caste secular category, so to say, in a way that a lot of the discussion about those kinds of inheritances and hierarchies in sort of post-independent India, increasingly in the last two decades, has occurred through the language of reservation, right? Reservation for marginalized caste groups in public higher education and public employment. And you give us a very sort of, you know, rigorous account of the land, so-called, you know, what has now become landmark legal battles and cases, right from the 1951 case in the Madras High Court to the 1992 and 2008 case in the Supreme Court, which produce a distinct language to talk about caste-based discrimination in only one way. And in a way that a through line in the book is the discourse that is produced, the languages in way which people can talk about caste inheritance through sort of a certain idea of castelessness and merit. And in a sense, what law leaves unnamed, as you say, which is caste inheritance, that we were just describing, as a basis of achievement, which politics does not. And as a reader and inheritor of a certain set of privilege and achievements myself, I was so drawn into the ways in which the discourse of merit is reproduced through three categories, which are so often used not only in sort of spectacular legal debates, but also in ordinary conversations about the idea of merit and in sort of pedagogy itself. And I wanted to, for our listeners, to trace the ways in which you describe them in your book. And I have three in my mind, which are very crucial to that kind of reproduction of merit as castelessness, which is the idea of the community. Secondly, the idea of middle classness. And thirdly, this category, this moniker, as it were, of the general caste. So can you, by the way, of sort of tracing the way in which you trace these three categories in the book itself, tell us about how this set of inheritances is remade by being disavowed and reconfigured in what we can even call, as you do, the alibis of caste?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story of how caste privilege becomes invisible, right? And other discursive terms come to stand in for caste belonging, right? And one of the arguments I'm making is that, with the advent of independence, and the institution of formal equality, there's a way in which lower castes remain marked by their caste status, by their caste belonging, while upper castes come to be unmarked, right? And paradoxically, this happens. It happens, through a variety of mechanisms. But one of the key mechanisms that I look at is reservations, right? So paradoxically, the commitment to caste-based reservations as a mechanism of redress, right, for historical injustices, ends up reinforcing the invisibility of privilege, right? And it does so by making only sort of one side, right, of the equation marked by caste. So it's only those who are eligible for the reserved category who are identified on the basis of their caste, caste, right? So caste identity is marked when it comes to the reserved category. But not when it comes to the other side, right, which is the general category of merit-based admissions. So this sort of absenting of caste from the general category has played a really crucial role in allowing upper castes to claim a form of castelessness, right, and to inhabit merit as a collective property, right? And the other way that this happens, so there's the reservation debate and the sort of and the distinction between the reserved and the general, right? Which kind of plays into the invisibilizing of caste when it comes to upper castes. There's also a kind of discourse of middle classness, which allows for the same kind of thing to happen. And one of the things that I do in the book, and this again sort of brings us back to why technical education is so important, right? I mean, technical education is really, you know, seen as the vehicle for middle class advancement, right? If one just looks at the number of engineering colleges that are there in India today, I mean, in 1947, when India became independent, there were fewer than 100 engineering colleges, and there's been an explosion since, right? In part because of massive state investment, right? In a technologically driven model of development, which had its kind of corollary in the education field in the proliferation of engineering colleges, right? And engineering very quickly becomes the aspiration of an emerging middle class, right? And the IITs are kind of emblematic of this drive, right, to gain admission into engineering colleges as either a pathway into the middle class or a way of shoring up pre-existing forms of social capital, right? So it really is a site of aspiration that's almost sort of incomparable, right? I mean, I guess medicine would be another one, but I think engineering even more so, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you look at this kind of claim to castelessness on the part of an upper caste professional class, in part the way this claim is advanced is through middle classness, right? So I did a huge number of oral history interviews with IITians, both past and present. And, you know, one of the kind of recurring themes in these interviews was about their own middle class background, right? So they would make a point of stressing that they didn't come from landed wealth. They didn't come from industrial wealth, right? That, you know, we're not members of a business class, right? We are the intelligentsia, right? I mean, these are people, most of whose parents were civil servants, and who populated the ranks of the bureaucracy, right? So they had this sort of conception of themselves as, you know, of humble origins. And so this sort of claim to middle classness was a way of not speaking about caste, right? So caste privilege was bracketed in favor of a self-presentation as part of a middle class, right? So I think that's another way in which the kind of castelessness of this group really gets kind of foregrounded, right, over and above their caste belonging. And in the you had also mentioned community as another term, right? I
was thinking particularly of the way in which you tell us, in the way which you tell us about sort of the idea of Tamil Brahmins, particularly as a community, let's say. The fact that this is part of a tradition, this is part of a culture, this is part of the way it's projected, right? So if we speak to that in terms of the making of a community as also sort of a more, less prescriptive, but more of a sort of a achievement-oriented category.
Yes, yeah, that's right. The sort of Tamil Brahmin dimension of this story is perhaps one I should say a little bit more about. One of the things I've been asked when I've presented this material is what accounts for its strong regional focus. I'm talking about a set of national institutions, and I think it's worth it's worth saying that as with IIT Madras, I mean, IIT Madras is one among a number of IITs, and I expect that as with IIT Madras, where a regional history of caste has been hugely consequential in shaping the social dynamics of the institution, I expect that the same would be the case for any of the IITs, right? And not simply because a significant proportion of the student body is drawn from the region, and this is especially the case for the faculty, but also because of the relationship between these regional histories and a national institution, right? What does it mean for a national institution that is directly administered by the central government? What does it mean for an institution of this kind, right, to inhabit a regional space, right? What is the kind of relationship that it has to its regional environs, and how does that relationship play out within the institution? So that's one of the things that I was really interested in, and Tamil Brahmins are so key to this dynamic, this kind of relationship between IIT Madras to its regional environs because of the history of non-Brahminism, right? Non-Brahminism and Dravidianism as two movements that kind of swept the southeastern region and really transformed everything from everyday social life to the character of the state, and the kind of unique the unique hostility between these movements and Tamil Brahmins in particular. Has really given them a sense that that central government institutions like IIT Madras are a refuge, right? They're a refuge away from the hostilities of regional politics, right? So very early on, as soon as the institution was founded in 1959, you see Tamil Brahmins kind of making a claim on the institution, right? And doing so in part through speaking of their own unique cultural, right, affinity for higher education, right? So there are all these sort of arguments about Tamil Brahminism as intellectualism. Right, that the reason Tamil Brahmins in particular do so well in this highly competitive admissions exam is because there's a certain sort of culture of learning, right, that makes them uniquely predisposed, right, to do well in these kinds of exams. So there's a kind of culturalist argument that's advanced, right, that sits next to the kind of middle class argument in really interesting ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, yeah. I mean, in a sense, they both end up being sort of essentialist arguments about both culture and class, in the sense that certain caste groups and certain class groups are predisposed to a certain kind of, in the way that they're spoken of, certain kinds of essentialisms. And those essentialisms get reproduced through legal judgments, through the ways in which the politics of privilege conducts itself, and through the ways in which the response to a subaltern assertion of rights is crucial to understanding how it is showed again and again in the ways you do describe in the book amazingly. That, you know, and in a way that leads me to my next question, which is the ways in which you trace this reproduction of caste inheritance, not only in the story of IIT Madras or the five national IITs first and then more within India, but the way in which it travels and circulates globally to create a certain brand India, which it becomes brand IIT in so many ways, right? And it is particularly it's not lost on either you or me that we are we're going to be discussing something like brand IIT in the aftermath of just the day after a series of very very oppressive ways in which the current central government is quelling student protests across the country in response to the kinds of protests about citizenship being at the stake of these protests, right? The idea that they're dear to the current government about a brand India being at the stake of these protests in a way that they may understand it. So in that spirit, actually, I wanted to ask you about how you address caste in the diaspora studies of India in a very, very interesting way, and how you highlight a story which we don't hear very often is the movement of Indian migrants post the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, which becomes a kind of self-selection, right, from among the highly skilled, which is perhaps another word at this moment for a predominantly upper caste formation. And this, in your own words, it means a balancing act between the marking and unmarking of caste as an achievement between India and between the US. So can you tell our listeners more about the kinds of, if I can use that word, self-racialization of upper caste in response to the kinds of racial stratification that operates in the US? For example, how claims of being members of the Aryan race in the early 20th century for claiming naturalization give way to claims of class, claims of nationality as by way of being foreign, or educational achievement as well, to fashion themselves as a modern minority in a way you tell the story, particularly through highlighting the formation of brand IIT, which itself has moved from the kind of prestige it accumulates through the early years of most of the IIT diasporic alumni in academic research and corporate employment, to now entrepreneurial success and wealth accumulation. So what are these kinds of sort of connections and disconnections between the ways in which the predominantly forward caste diaspora and the making of the brand IIT, what kinds of self-racialization it kind of, it presents to do something like this?
Yeah. So I have, I've been really interested in the US Indian diaspora for quite a while. And I've been struck by the absence of caste in a lot of this mm-hmm. literature, which tends to foreground other kinds of categories, right? Of religion, region, gender, sexuality, class. I mean, there's a lot that is it's a very rich literature, but caste is kind of marked by its absence, right? It's almost as if when it's left behind, right, in the kind of journey over. When I looked at the IIT diaspora, it was really clear to me that the forms of capital, right, the forms of caste capital that an IIT pedigree helps to shore up become crucial, right, to the professional and economic successes of diasporic IITians, right? And I use the term institutional caste kinship to talk about these forms of capital. Anyone who knows anything about the IITs knows that this is an incredibly strong corporate identity, right? People, it really is, most most institutions of higher education do produce their graduates as certain kinds of subjects. And this is certainly the case for the IITs. I mean, IITians come out of this experience identifying very strongly, right, with the institution. And so this kind of kinship that's forged while on campus and then is kind of kept alive and mobilized after one leaves. I tracked how it plays out in the diaspora to ensure, you know, everything from, you know, admission into graduate programs, you know, seed funding for various kinds of entrepreneurial endeavors, and how, you know, it wasn't simply that it worked in this kind of subterranean way, right? There was a very kind of explicit project of self-racialization that IIT alumni in the diaspora embarked on. And I mean, one can see this kind of coalescing, this kind of project of self-racialization. One can see it coalescing in the, you know, starting sort of in the 80s on. So the first batch of IITians, migration out of India started very early. Even as early as the 1960s, you had people coming to the U.S. But it really sort of picks up pace, right, in the 70s and 80s. And the folks who come here early on, you know, it takes a couple of decades for them to sort of find their footing, right? A lot of them come here for higher education, and then, you know, with the IT boom, many of them exit out of academia and into business, right? The Silicon Valley boom becomes this incredibly important moment, right, for many of these IITians to find their way to California. And once they're there, they become this kind of critical mass that's able to work collectively, right, to shore up this notion of brand IIT and make it legible to American society, right? There's this. I mean, there are lots of ways that this this project of brand IIT gets narrated, but one of the moments that almost everybody identified as pivotal was the airing of this documentary, of a 60 minutes episode on the IITs, which aired in 2003. And it was this kind of almost like a promotional ad, right, for the IITs. And it told the story of a set of institutions in India, which were islands of meritocracy, right, within a kind of larger, space of underdevelopment, right? Islands of meritocracy in which you had these unique forms of entrepreneurialism, and this is important, right? Not just intellectualism, but entrepreneurialism cultivated, which then, you know, once these graduates come to the U.S., they're able to sort of realize this untapped potential, right? That the U.S. provides them a space of opportunity to really kind of manifest themselves, you know, as not just as wealth producers, but as kind of emblematic Indians, right? who kind of put India on the global stage in a way that was not possible before. So they kind of style themselves both as kind of entrepreneurial geniuses, right? These sort of self-made men, and most of them are men, but also as sort of ambassadors, right? National ambassadors, right? Who bring a kind of relatively sort of untold story of India to the global stage, right? And so this kind of project of Brand IIT is a way of doing all of that, but also it's an interesting way of claiming a model minority status in the United States, right? So, you know, all the way through the 20th century, you see these efforts on the part of elite Indians to stave off the threat of racialization, right? By claiming a kind of difference from other racial minorities in the U.S. And in the early, you know, you mentioned this, Bhumika, in the 1910s, you know, they did so through a claim to whiteness, right? As members of the Aryan race. In the mid 20th century, you know, this was done more through a claim to a professional class status, right? So in, you know, after the 1965 Immigration Act, when, you know, there's a kind of the floodgates open and all of these sort of upper caste professionals come to the U.S., you know, that becomes the sort of basis for claiming a kind of model minority status. And it's no longer necessary to claim whiteness, right? It's possible now within a sort of new, you know, supposedly multicultural America to claim status through through Indianness, right? Through a kind of Indian, through a sort of blend of Indianness and professional class status. And then by the 2000s, I mean, you see this, the entrepreneurialism claim becomes yet another way, right? To argue for their difference from other racial minorities, right? As having this kind of model character because of their contributions, right, to the American economy, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I mean, I think that more work needs to be done on the U.S. Indian diaspora that looks at this very complicated way in which elites, in particular, bring race, caste, and class together in their kind of projects of self-making, right?
No, that's yes. Thank you. That's fantastic. And you know, there's always in the way that you sort of manage to reproduce those conversations and the ways in which people talk about their own caste identities and inheritances, even just sort of listening to and reading those conversations by itself is so telling, and becomes, as you know, it's a diagnostic in some sense, as you keep telling us through the book, the kinds of caste diagnostics that people are looking out for to guess what claims who can make about what kinds of talent and merit, whether it's in the diaspora or even, you know, within that national territory of India, so to speak. And that, you know, I also was thinking in a way, which is always a crucial question about books that are written, and never the least significant question is two things I wanted to know about the writing of the book as well, which is about the ways in which you were able to set up these kinds of conversations and even have them, because I'm trying to think of the kinds of censoring that goes on in talking about upper casteness. So the ways in which you as a researcher, as a scholar, as an anthropologist, as an ethnographer, had to, the ways that you had to look out for claims to castelessness in these conversations when they may have been extremely, extremely indirect as well as direct. So I wanted to know more about the kinds of, not, you know, upper caste diagnostics that in some sense you had to perhaps cultivate on the fly as a researcher talking about these kinds of entitlements and inheritances. And the second question, which I also had when I was reading the book, and to the moment I finished, I was like, oh my God, what are these people thinking? Like, have, in a sense, thinking about your work and about your book in a way that, has it traveled? Has any of it, have they been reading stuff that you've been writing about the book? The book has, I know, come out only recently, so it'll be a while before it sort of starts circulating in that sense. But they've responded to what you have made of these conversations and these stories, and has there been any kind of justifying or not, or debating the kinds of claims that you make in the book itself? So those are my two sort of final questions about the book in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, the first one is it's a really interesting question, right? How does one get at unmarking? Right. And, you know, one of the things that I did is use oral history, right, as a way of getting at patterns of self-narration, right, that had a kind of remarkable consistency across interviews, right? You know, the way people mark or don't mark caste belonging, right? And you know, sometimes this has to do with, you know, their position on certain, you know, hot button topics, you know, whether it's reservations or, low caste movements, or the transformation of the Indian bureaucracy. I mean, there were all of these really interesting topics which people sort of took positions on, which, you know, kind of spoke to their own forms of caste identification, right? So I had to sort of attune my ear for those sorts of arguments. I mean, sometimes, you know, it would take the form of an explicit avowal and disavowal. So people would say, yes, I'm Brahmin, but I don't think of myself as Brahmin. I mean, I grew up in, you know, a cosmopolitan setting where we really didn't sort of think of ourselves in caste terms, right? So sometimes there was that kind of claim to a sort of liberal transcendence of caste, right? So there were all these like different ways in which, you know, the kind of, you know, this kind of back and forth between marking and unmarking worked. I had to sort of, you know, you put it really nicely, you know, I had to sort of cultivate my own kind of caste diagnostics, right? To get at these. And I think I got better over time. Your second question was about the reception, right? Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I published a piece, a journal article in 2015, which really anticipates the book and makes a lot of the same arguments. And, you know, if there's one thing that IITians do very well, it's track their own, track media, right, on the IITs. And so, you know, when I did these interviews, many people did say that they had read something of mine, you know, either that they knew about that piece, or that they'd read journalistic pieces I'd written. And it was an odd thing because I expected much more pushback than I got. And the only way I can explain that is that, you know, they really saw me as one of theirs, right? I mean, both because of my institutional location at Harvard, and also because, you know, I have an upper caste name. And so I think there was this almost a kind of active denial that I could be making the kinds of arguments that I was making. You know, I mean, many of them were sort of older men who in my conversations with them would liken me to their daughters. So there was a kind of embrace almost, right, of me. And I don't think that this came out of me being dishonest. I think there was a genuine inability, perhaps, or unwillingness to attribute a kind of critical or even hostile intent to me because of who I am. So I mean, I'm curious to see. I'm already getting emails from some of my interviewees saying that, you know, they know that the book is out and they're looking forward to reading it. So I expect a lot of the more maybe more of the kind of critical reaction will come once the book is in circulation. But it remains to be seen. I'm not sure.
It's one of those funny things where when you do want a very critical, perhaps a reaction to the ways in which you're writing, because, and maybe not, because either way it resonates with what you've been saying and what we've been discussing about the unmarking.
Exactly. It's a very interesting phenomenon. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ajanta. I have taken up some of your time today, but and there is so much more to be said about the book and to be discussed, but I'm sure there are going to be other avenues where you will do that. And this was a very, very enjoyable conversation. But before I let you go, I also have to ask you, what is it that you're working on next, and what can we expect to read from
It's, I have to say, it's so nice to be thinking about something else now. Because as you know, these academic projects last forever. And so I am just starting, I'm literally at the very beginning stages of a new project on gold mining. And so the hope is that I will eventually write a historical ethnography of the Kolar gold fields in the state of Karnataka. And, you know, this was the site of the largest gold mining operation during the colonial period. They started operating in the 1880s, and they were finally shut down in 2001, although sort of production levels steadily declined after the mid-20th century. And at the moment, I'm interested in kind of three angles on the project. So the first is trying to understand KGF, Kolar Goldfields, KGF, as an instance of nested sovereignty. And what I mean by that is, you know, this was a colonial company town that was situated within Mysore, which was an Indian princely state that was indirectly ruled by the British. So I want to understand how these kinds of concessions for, you know, incredibly lucrative extractive industries functioned, and what this can tell us about like the spatial ordering of sovereignty, right, and its relationship to capitalism. And I'm also really interested in the colonial company town itself as a form, right, like as a traveling technology, both of social classification, but also of labor control. The company that oversaw the operations at KGF was the was John Taylor and Sons, which was this British company that had previously operated silver mines in Mexico. And the company also sent officials to gold mines in South Africa to gather in, you know, to do sort of fact-finding missions to gather insights about how to run a successful operation in India. So I really want to look at the colonial company town as a site for the transnational traffic in ideas and strategies, right? And how it instrumentalizes these different categories of race, caste, class, et cetera, as part of a managerial worldview, right? I mean, and how that kind of shaped operations at KGF. And then, of course, you know, caste is really key here, as it is in all of my work. Most of the laborers in KGF were landless Dalits from Northern Madras Presidency, who migrated to KGF to become part of the industrial workforce. And so I'm really interested in understanding the relationship between, you know, caste and class, but also between agrarian and industrial spaces and how they figure in the kind of making of a Dalit working class. So those are the kind of angles on the project that I'm thinking about right now. And I'm hoping that this will be a more collaborative than the last two projects. I got some of these ideas from the work of a former student named Ranjini Srinivasan, who did her master's thesis at the Harvard Design, the Graduate School of Design at Harvard. And she wrote her master's thesis on the spatial and ecological dimensions of the KGF story. So I'm hoping to continue to collaborate with her and also with Elizabeth Ferry, who's an anthropologist at Brandeis, who's worked on silver mining in Mexico and wants to look at the Real del Monte silver mines where John Taylor and Sons first embarked on mining. So, you know, I mean, a lot of us who do anthropological work, I mean, our research is inherently collaborative, but we don't really foreground that in the way we write. I really want this to be a much more explicitly collaborative endeavor.
That is fantastic. I mean, this is very exciting, especially given that the stuff that we do have on Company Towns is mostly, as far as I know, a story of post-independence India and sort of the Soviet collaboration and the West German collaboration on these kind of technologies and Company Towns that came as story of nationalism. So that this insight about colonial company town in that sense, I'm sure is something that'd be very, very useful and significant for what you're calling these sort of traveling technologies. So that's very exciting. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And all the best with a collaboration project. Maybe more of these. Thank you so much for your time today, Ajanta. Thanks, and bye-bye.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.